room with the refrigerator noise. Came back out a minute later carrying a rifle. It was a Remington M24, with a loopholed ultra scope and a front bipod. A standard issue Marine sniper's weapon. It looked to be well used, but in excellent condition. Cash placed it sideways on the counter, detached the magazine and showed Reacher that it was empty, operated the bolt and showed Reacher that the chamber was empty too. Reflex, routine, caution, professional courtesy. "Mine," he said. "Zeroed for 300 yards exactly. By me, myself, personally." "Good enough," Reacher said, which it was. An ex-Marine, who in 1978 had been the third best shooter in the world, could be trusted on such matters. "One shot," Cash said. He took a single cartridge from his pocket, held it up. It was a 300 Winchester round, match grade. He stood it upright on the X on the paper target. It hit it entirely. Then he smiled. Reacher smiled back. He understood the challenge. He understood it perfectly. "Hit the X, and I'll talk to you about James Barr." "At least it's not hand-to-hand combat," Reacher thought. "Let's go," he said. Outside, the air was still, and it was neither hot nor cold. Perfect shooting weather. No shivering, no risk of thermals or currents or shimmer, no wind. Cash carried the rifle and the target, and Reacher carried the cartridge in the palm of his hand. They climbed into Cash's Humvee together, and Cash fired it up with a loud diesel clatter. "You like this thing?" Reacher asked over the noise.
"Not really," Cash said. "I'd be happier with a sedan, but it's a question of image. Customers like it."
The landscape was all low hills, covered in grass and stunted trees. Someone had used a bulldozer to carve wide, straight paths through it. The paths were hundreds of yards apart, and hundreds of yards long, and all of them were parallel. Each path was a separate rifle range. Each range was isolated from the others by natural hills and backed by high berms made from the earth scraped up by the bulldozer. The whole place looked like a half-built golf course. It was part green, part raw, all covered with red earth gashes. White-painted rocks and boulders delineated tracks through it, some for vehicles, some for foot traffic.
"My family has owned this land forever," Cash said. "The range was my idea. I thought I could be like a golf pro or tennis. You know those guys, they've been on the tour, they retire, they set up teaching afterward."
"Did it work?" Reacher asked.
"Not really," Cash said. "People come here to shoot, but to get a guy to admit he doesn't really know how is like pulling teeth."
Reacher saw three pickup trucks parked at separate shooting stations. The guys who had been waiting at 8 o'clock were well into their morning sessions. They were all prone on coconut mats, firing, pausing, sighting, firing again.
"It's a living," Cash said,
in answer to a question Reacher hadn't asked. Then he pulled the Humvee off the main track and drove 300 yards down the length of an empty range. He got out and clipped the paper target to a frame and got back in, and Kay turned the truck and headed back. He parked it neatly and shut it down.
"Good luck," he said.
Reacher sat still for a moment. He was more nervous than he should have been. He breathed in and held it and felt the thrill of caffeine in his veins. Just a tiny, microscopic tremble. 4 fast cups of strong coffee were not an ideal preparation for accurate long-distance shooting. But it was only 300 yards.
300 yards, with a good rifle, no heat, no cold, still air. More or less the same thing as pressing the muzzle into the center of the target and pulling the trigger. He could do it with his eyes closed. There was no fundamental problem with the marksmanship. The problem was with the stakes. He wanted the puppet master more than he had wanted the Marine's Cup all those years before. A lot more. He didn't know why, but that was the problem. He breathed out. It was only 300 yards, not 6, not 8, not 1,000, no big deal. He slid out of the Humvee and took the rifle off the back seat, carried it across rough earth to the coconut mat, placed it gently with its bipod feet a yard back from the edge, bent down and loaded it, stepped back behind it, and lined himself up and crouched, knelt, lay full length. He snuggled the stock into his shoulder, eased his neck left and right, and looked around. It felt like he was alone in the middle of nowhere. He ducked his head, closed his left eye, and moved his right eye to the scope, draped his left hand over the barrel, and pressed down and back. Now he had a tripod mount, the bipod and his shoulder. Solid. He spread his legs and turned his feet out so they were flat on the mat, drew his left leg up a little, and dug the sole of his shoe into the mat's fibers so the dead weight of the limb anchored his position. He relaxed and let himself sprawl. He knew he must look like a guy who had been shot instead of a guy preparing to shoot. He gazed through the scope, saw the hyper-vivid image of great optics. He acquired the target. It looked close enough to touch. He laid the reticle where the two strokes of the X met, squeezed the slack out of the trigger, relaxed, breathed out. He could feel his heart. It felt like it was loose in his chest. The caffeine was buzzing in his veins. The reticle was dancing over the X. It was hopping and jerking, left and right, up and down, in a tiny random circle. He closed his right eye, willed his heart to stop, breathed out, and kept his lungs empty 1 second, 2. Then again, in, out, hold. He pulled all his energy downward into his gut, let his shoulders slacken, let his muscles relax, let himself settle. He opened his eye again and saw that the reticle was still. He stared at the target, feeling it, wanting it. He pulled the trigger. The gun kicked and roared, and the muzzle blast blew a cloud of dust out of the coconut mat and obscured his view. He lifted his head and coughed once and ducked back to the scope. Bullseye. The X was gone. There was a neat hole drilled through the center of it, leaving only 4 tiny ballpoint ticks visible, one at the top and one at the bottom of each stroke. He coughed again and pushed back and stood up. Cash dropped down in his place and used the scope to check the result.
"Good shooting," he said.
"Good rifle," Reacher said. Cash operated the bolt and the spent case fell out on the mat. He got to his knees and picked it up and put it in his pocket. Then he stood up and carried the rifle back toward the Humvee.
"So do I qualify?" Reacher called after him.
"For what?"
"For talking to?"
Cash turned around.
"You think this was a test?"
"I sincerely hope it was."
"You might not want to hear what I've got to say."
"Try me," Reacher said. Cash nodded.
"We'll talk in the office."
They detoured up the length of the range for Cash to retrieve the target. Then they turned and drove back to the huts. They passed the pickup guys. They were still blasting away. Cash parked, and they went inside, and Cash filed Reacher's target in a drawer under R for Richardson. Then he danced his fingers forward to B for Bar and pulled out a thick sheaf of paper.
"You looking to show your old buddy didn't do it?" he asked.
"He wasn't my buddy," Reacher said. "I knew him once, is all."
"And?"
"I don't remember him being that great a shooter."
"TV News said it was pretty short range,
with moving targets and deflection angles."
"TV said the evidence is pretty clear."
"It is," Reacher said. "I've seen it."
"Check these out," Cash said.
He dealt the filed targets like a deck of cards, all along the length of the counter. Then he butted them edge to edge and squared them off to make room for more. Then he started a second row directly underneath the first. In the end, he had 32 sheets of paper displayed, two long rows of repetitive concentric circles, all of them marked J-bar 300 yards, with times and dates stretching back 3 years.
"Read them and weep," Cash said.
Every single target showed an expert score. Reacher stared at them, one after the other. Each inner ring was tightly packed with clean, crisp holes, tight clusters, big and obvious. 32 targets, 10 rounds each, 320 rounds, all of them dead on, maximum scores.
"This is everything he did?" Reacher asked.
Cash nodded.
"Like you said, I'm a record keeper."
"What gun?"
"His own Supermatch."
"Great rifle." "Did the cops call you?"
"Guy called Emerson. He was pretty decent about it, because I've got to think about my own ass, because Barr trained here. I don't want to damage my professional reputation. I put in a lot of work here, and this place could get a bad name."
Reacher scanned the targets one more time. Remembered telling Helen Roden, "They don't forget." "What about his buddy Charlie?" he asked.
"Charlie was hopeless by comparison."
Cash butted James Barr's targets into a pile and put them back in the B slot. Then he opened another drawer and ran his fingers back to S and took out another sheaf of paper.
"Charlie Smith," he said. "He was military, too, by the look of him. But Uncle Sam's money didn't buy anything long-term there."
He went through the same routine, laying out Charlie's targets in two long rows, 32 of them.
"They always showed up together," Reacher asked. "Like peanut butter and jelly," Cash said.
"Separate ranges?"
"Separate planets," Cash said.
Reacher nodded. In terms of numerical score, Charlie's targets were much worse than James Barr's. Way worse. They were the product of a very poor shooter. One had just 4 hits, all of them outside the outer ring, one each in the quadrants in the corners. Across all 32 targets, he had just 8 hits inside the inner ring. One was a dead-on bullseye. Dumb luck, maybe, or wind, or drift, or a random thermal. 7 were very close to clipping the black. Apart from that, Charlie was all over the place. Most of his rounds must have missed altogether. Percentage-wise, most of his hits happened in the white between the two outer rings. Low, low scores. But his hits weren't precisely random. There was a weird kind of consistency there. He was aiming, but he was missing. Maybe some kind of bad astigmatism in his eyes. "What type of a guy was he?" Reacher asked.
"Charlie?" Cash said. "Charlie was a blank slate. Couldn't read him at all. If he had been a better shot, he'd have come close to frightening me.
Small guy, right?
Tiny. Weird hair.
Did they talk to you much?
Not really. They were just two guys down from Indiana, getting off on shooting guns. I get a lot of that here.
Did you watch them shoot? Cash shook his head.
I learned never to watch anybody. People take it as a criticism. I let them come to me, but nobody ever does.
Barr bought his ammo here, right?
Lake City. Expensive.
His gun wasn't cheap either.
He was worth it.
What gun did Charlie use?
The same thing. Like a matched pair. In his case, it was a comedy, like a fat guy who buys a carbon fiber racing bike.
You got separate handgun ranges here?
One indoor. People use it if it rains. Otherwise, I let them blast away outside anywhere they want. I don't care much for handguns. No art to them.
Reacher nodded, and Cash swept Charlie's targets into a pile, careful to keep them in correct date order. Then he stacked them together and put them back in the S drawer.
Smith is a common name, Reacher said.
Actually, I think it's the most common name in America.
It was genuine, Cash said. I see a driver's license before anyone gets membership.
Where was he from originally?
Accent? Somewhere way north.
Can I take one of James Barr's targets?
What the hell for?
For a souvenir, Reacher said. Cash said nothing.
It won't go anywhere, Reacher said. I'm not going to sell it on the Internet.
Cash said nothing.
Barr's not coming back, Reacher said. That's for damn sure. And if you really want to cover your ass, you should dump them all anyway.
Cash shrugged and turned back to the file drawer.
The most recent one, Reacher said. That would be best.
Cash thumbed through the stack and pulled the sheet, handed it across the counter. Reacher took it and folded it carefully and put it in his shirt pocket.
Good luck with your buddy, Cash said.
He's not my buddy, Reacher said, but thanks for your help.
You're welcome.
Cash said.
Because I know who you are. I recognized you when you got behind the gun. I never forget the shape of a prone position. You won the Invitational 10 years after I was in it. I was watching from the crowd. Your real name is Reacher.
Reacher nodded.
Polite of you, Cash said. Not to mention it. After I told you how I only came in third.
You had tougher competition, Reacher said. 10 years later, it was all a bunch of deadbeats. He stopped at the last gas station in Kentucky and filled Yanni's tank. Then he called Helen Roden from a payphone.
Is the cop still there? He asked.
Two of them, she said. One in the lobby, one at my door.
Did Franklin start yet?
First thing this morning.
Any progress?
Nothing. They were five very ordinary people.
Where is Franklin's office?
She gave him an address. Reacher checked his watch. I'll meet you there at 4 o'clock.
How was Kentucky?
Confusing, he said.
He recrossed the Ohio on the same trestle bridge with Sheryl Crow telling him all over again about how every day was a winding road. He cranked up the volume and turned left and headed west. Anyani's maps showed a highway cloverleaf 40 miles ahead. He could turn north there, and a couple hours later he could scoot past the whole city 40 feet in the air. It seemed like a better idea than trying the surface streets. He figured Emerson would be getting seriously frustrated, and then seriously enraged at some point during the day. Reacher would have been. Reacher had been Emerson for 13 years, And in this kind of a situation, he would have been kicking ass big time, blanketing the streets with uniforms, trying everything. He found the cloverleaf and joined the highway going north. He killed the CD when it started over again and settled in for the cruise. The Mustang felt pretty good at 70 miles an hour. It rumbled along, lots of power, no finesse at all. Reacher figured if he could put that drivetrain in some battered old sedan body, then that would be his kind of car. Bill Antonio had been at work in his crime lab since 7 o'clock in the morning. He had fingerprinted the cell phone found abandoned under the highway and come up with nothing worth a damn. Then he had copied the call log. The last number dialed was Helen Roden's cell. Last but one was Emerson's cell. Clearly, Reacher had made both of those calls. Then came a long string of calls to several different cell phones registered to Specialized Services of Indiana. Maybe Reacher had made those, too, or maybe he hadn't. No way of knowing. Bill Antonio wrote it all up, but he knew Emerson wouldn't do anything with it. The only viable pressure point was the call to Helen Roden, and no way could Emerson start hassling a defense lawyer about a conversation with a witness, suspect or not. That would be a waste of breath. So he moved on to the garage tapes. He had 4 days' worth, 96 hours, nearly 3,000 separate vehicle movements. His staff had logged them all. Only three of them were Cadillacs. Indiana was the same as most heartland states. People bought pickup trucks as a first preference, then SUVs, then coupes, then convertibles. Regular sedans claimed a tiny market share, and most of them were Toyotas or Hondas or mid-sized domestics. Full-sized turnpike cruisers were very rare, and premium brands, rarest of all. The first Cadillac on tape was a bone-white Eldorado, a two-door coupe several years old. It had parked before 10 a.m. on the Wednesday and stayed parked for 5 hours. The second Cadillac on tape was a new STS. Maybe red or gray, possibly light blue. Hard to be sure with the murky monochrome picture. Whatever, it had parked soon after lunch on the Thursday and stayed there for 2 hours. The third Cadillac was a black DeVille. It was caught on tape entering the garage just after 6 o'clock in the morning on the Friday. Black Friday, as Bill Antonio was calling it. At 6 o'clock in the morning, the garage would have been more or less completely empty. The tape showed the DeVille sweeping up the ramp, fast and confident. It showed it leaving again after just 4 minutes. Long enough to place the cone. The driver wasn't really visible in either sequence. There was just a gray blur behind the windshield. Maybe it was Barr, maybe it wasn't. Bill Antonio wrote it all up for Emerson. He made a mental note to check through again to determine if 4 minutes was the shortest stay on the tapes. He suspected it was, easily. Then he scanned the forensic sweep through Alexandra Dupre's garden apartment. He had assigned a junior guy to do it because it wasn't the crime scene. There was nothing of interest there, nothing at all, except the fingerprint evidence. The apartment was a mess of prints, like all apartments are. Most of them were the girls, but there were four other sets. Three of them were unidentifiable. The fourth set of prints belonged to James Barr. James Barr had been in Alexandra Dupre's apartment, in the living room, in the kitchen, in the bathroom. No doubt about it. Clear prints, perfect matches, unmistakable. Bill Antonio wrote it up for Emerson. Then he read a report just in from the medical examiner. Alexandra Dupre had been killed by a single, massive blow to the right temple, delivered by a left-handed assailant. She had fallen onto a gravel surface that contained organic matter, including grass and dirt, but she had been found in an alley paved with limestone. Therefore, Her body had been moved at least a short distance between death and discovery. Other physiological evidence confirmed it. Bill Antonio took a new sheet of memo paper and addressed two questions to Emerson. Is Reacher left-handed? Did he have access to a vehicle? The Zek spent the morning hours deciding what to do with Raskin. Raskin had failed three separate times. First with the initial tail, then by getting attacked from behind, and finally by letting his cell phone get stolen. The Zek didn't like failure. He didn't like it at all. At first, he considered just pulling Raskin off the street and restricting him to duty in the video room on the ground floor of the house. But why would he want to depend on a failure to monitor his security? Then Linsky called. They had been searching 14 straight hours and had found no sign of the soldier. "We should go after the lawyer now," Linsky said. "After all, nothing can happen without her. She's the focal point. She's the one making the moves here."
"That raises the stakes," the Zek said.
"They're already pretty high."
Maybe the soldier's gone for good."
"Maybe he is," Linsky said. "But what matters is what he left behind, in the lawyer's head."
"I'll think about it," the Zek said. "I'll get back to you."
"Should we keep on looking?"
"Tired?"
Linsky was exhausted and his spine was killing him.
"No," he lied. "I'm not tired."
"So keep on looking," the Zek said. "But send Raskin back to me." Richard slowed to 50 where the highway first rose on its stilts. He stayed in the center lane and let the spur that ran behind the library pass by on his right. He kept on north for 2 more miles and came off at the cloverleaf that met the 4-lane with the auto dealers and the parts store. He went east on the county road and then turned north again on Jeb Oliver's rural route. After a minute, he was deep in the silent countryside. The irrigation booms were turning slowly, and the sun was making rainbows in the droplets. The heartland, where the secrets are. He coasted to a stop next to the Oliver's mailbox. No way was the Mustang going to make it down the driveway. The center hump would have ripped all the parts off the bottom. The suspension, the exhaust system, the axle, the diff, whatever else was down there. Anyani wouldn't have been pleased at all. So he slid out and left the car where it was, low and crouched and winking blue in the sun. He picked his way down the track, feeling every rock and stone through his thin soles. Jeb Oliver's red Dodge hadn't been moved. It was sitting right there, lightly dusted with brown dirt and streaked with dried dew. The old farmhouse was quiet. The barn was closed and locked. Richard ignored the front door. He walked around the side of the house to the back porch. Jeb's mother was right there on her glider. She was dressed the same, but this time she had no bottle, just a manic stare out of eyes as big as saucers. She had one foot hooked up under her, and was using the other to scoot the chair about twice as fast as she had before.
"Hello," she said.
"Jeb not back yet?" Reacher said.
She just shook her head. Reacher heard all the sounds he had heard before. The irrigation hiss, the squeak of the glider, the creak of the porch board.
"Got a gun?" he asked.
"I don't hold with him," she said.
"Got a phone?" he asked.
"Disconnected," she said. "I owe them money, but I don't need them. Jeb lets me use his cell if I need it."
"Good," Reacher said.
"How the hell is that good? Jeb's not here."
"That's exactly what's good about it. I'm going to break into your barn, and I don't want you calling the cops while I'm doing it. Or shooting me."
"That's Jeb's barn. You can't go in there." I don't see how you can stop me.
He turned his back on her and continued down the track. It curved a little and led directly to the barn's double doors. The doors, like the barn itself, were built of old planks, alternately baked and rotted by 100 summers and 100 winters. Reacher touched them with his knuckles and felt a dry hollowness. The lock was brand new. It was a U-shaped bicycle lock like the ones city messengers used. One leg of the U ran through 2 black steel hasps that were bolted through the planks of the doors. Reacher touched the lock, shook it, heavy steel warm from the sun. It was a pretty solid arrangement. No way of cutting it, no way of breaking it. But a lock was only as strong as what it was fixed to. Reacher grabbed the straight end of the lock at the bottom of the U, pulled on it gently, and then harder. The doors sagged toward him and stopped. He put the flat of his palm against the wood and pushed them back, held them closed with a straight left arm, and yanked on the lock with his right. The bolts gave a little, but not much. Reacher figured that Jeb must have used washers on the back, under the nuts, maybe big wide ones. They were spreading the load. He thought, okay, more load. He held the straight part of the lock with both hands and leaned back like a water skier, pulled hard, and smashed his heel into the wood under the hasps. His legs were longer than his arms, so he was cramped and the kick didn't carry much power, but it carried enough. The old wood splintered a little, and something gave 1/2 inch. He regrouped and tried it again. Something gave a little more. Then a plank in the left-hand door split completely, and 2 bolts pulled out. Reacher put his left hand flat on the door and got his right-hand fingers hooked in the gap with a backhand grip. He took a breath and counted to 3 and jerked hard. The last bolt fell out, and the whole lock assembly hit the ground, and the doors sagged all the way open. Reacher stepped away and folded the doors back flush with the walls and let the sunlight in. He guessed he was expecting to see a meth lab, maybe with workbenches and beakers and scales and propane burners and piles of new baggies ready to receive the product, or else a big stash ready for onward distribution. He saw none of that. Bright light leaked in through long vertical gaps between warped planks. The barn was maybe 40 feet by 20 inside. It had a bare earth floor, swept and compacted. It was completely empty, except for a well-used pickup truck parked in the exact center of the space. The truck was a Chevy Silverado, several years old. It was light brown, like fired clay. It was a working vehicle. It had been built down to a plain specification, a base model. Vinyl seats, steel wheels, undramatic tires. The load bed was clean, but scratched and dented. It had no license plates. The doors were locked, and there was no sign of a key anywhere.
What's that?
Reacher turned and saw Jeb Oliver's mother behind him. She had her hand tight on the door jamb, like she was unwilling to cross the threshold. It's a truck, Reacher said.
I can see that.
Is it Jeb's?
I never saw it before.
What did he drive before that big red thing?
Not this.
Reacher stepped closer to the truck and peered in through the driver's side window. Manual shift, dirt and grime, high mileage, but no trash. The truck had been someone's faithful servant, used, but not abused.
I never saw it before,
the woman said again. It looked like it had been there for a long time. It was settled on soft tires. It didn't smell of oil or gasoline. It was cold, inert, filmed with dust. Reacher got on his knees and checked underneath. Nothing to see, just a frame, caked with old dirt, clipped by rocks and gravel.
How long has this thing been in here?
He he asked from the floor.
I don't know.
When did he put the lock on the door?
Maybe 2 months ago.
Richard stood up again.
What did you expect to find?
The woman asked him. Richard turned to face her and looked at her eyes. The pupils were huge.
More of what you had for breakfast, he said.
She smiled.
You thought Jeb was cooking in here?
Wasn't he?
His stepfather brings it by.
You married?
Not anymore, but it still brings it by.
Jeb was using on Monday night, Reacher said. The woman smiled again.
A mother can share with her kid, can't she? What else is a mother for?
Reacher turned away and looked at the truck one more time. Why would he keep an old truck locked in here and a new truck out in the weather?
Beats me,
the woman said.
Jeb Allis does things his own way.
Richard backed out of the barn and walked each door closed. Then he used the balls of his thumbs to press the bolts back into their splintered holes. The weight of the lock dragged them all halfway out again. He got it looking as neat as he could, and then he left it alone and walked away.
Is Jeb ever coming back?
The woman called after him. Richard didn't answer. The Mustang was facing north, so Richard drove north. He put the CD player on loud and kept going 10 miles down an arrow straight road, aiming for a horizon that never arrived. Ruskin dug his own grave with a Caterpillar backhoe. It was the same machine that had been used to level the Zex land. It had a 20-inch entrenching shovel with 4 steel teeth on it. The shovel took long, slow bites of the soft earth and laid them aside. The engine roared and slowed, and pulsed clouds of diesel exhaust filled the Indiana sky. Ruskin had been born during the Soviet Union, and he had seen a lot. Afghanistan, Chechnya, unthinkable upheaval in Moscow. A guy in his position could have been dead many times over, and that fact, combined with his natural Russian fatalism, made him utterly indifferent to his fate. Ukas, the Zek had said. An order from an absolute authority. Nichevo, Ruskin had said in reply. Think nothing of it. So he worked the backhoe. He chose a spot concealed from the stone crusher's view by the bulk of the house. He dug a neat trench, 20 inches wide, 6 feet long, 6 feet deep. He piled the excavated earth to his right, to the east, like a high barrier between himself and home. When he was finished, he backed the machine away from the hole and shut it down, climbed down from the cab, and waited. There was no escape, no point in running. If he ran, they would find him anyway, and then he wouldn't need a grave. They would use garbage bags, 5 or 6 of them. They would use wire ties to seal the several parts of him into cold, black plastic. They would put bricks in with his flesh and throw the bags in the river. He had seen it happen before. In the distance, the Zek came out of his house. A short, wide man, ancient, stooped, walking at a moderate speed, exuding power and energy. He picked his way across the uneven ground, glancing down, glancing forward. 50 yards, 100. He came close to Ruskin and stopped. He put his ruined hand in his pocket and came out with a small revolver, his thumb and the stump of his index finger pincered through the trigger guard. He held it out, and Ruskin took it from him.
Ukas, the Zek said.
Nichevo,
Ruskin replied. A short, amiable, self-deprecating sound like de rien in French, like de nada in Spanish, like prego
in Italian. Please, I'm yours to command. Thank you, the Zek said. Raskin stepped away to the narrow end of the trench, opened the revolver's cylinder, and saw a single cartridge. Closed the cylinder again and turned it until it was lined up right. Then he pulled the hammer back and put the barrel in his mouth. He turned around so that he was facing the Zek and his back was to the trench. He shuffled backward until his heels were on the edge of the hole. He stood still and straight and balanced and composed, like an Olympic diver preparing for a difficult backward pike off the high board. He closed his eyes. He pulled the trigger. For a mile around, black crows rose noisily into the air. Blood and brain and bone arced through the sunlight in a perfect parabola. Ruskin's body fell backward and landed stretched out and flat in the bottom of the trench. The crows settled back to earth, and the faint noise of the distant stone-crushing machines rolled back in and sounded like silence. Then the Zek clambered up into the Caterpillar's cab and started the engine. The levers all had knobs as big as pool balls, which made them easy to manipulate with his palms. Reacher stopped 15 miles north of the city and parked the Mustang on a big V-shaped gravel turnout made where the corners of two huge circular fields met. There were fields everywhere, north, south, east, and west, one after the other in endless ranks and files. Each one had its own irrigation boom. Each boom was turning at the same slow, patient pace. He shut the engine down and slid out of the seat. He stood and stretched and yawned. The air was full of mist from the booms. Up close, the booms were like massive industrial machines, like alien spaceships recently landed. There was a central vertical standpipe in the middle of each field, like a tall metal chimney. The boom arm came off it horizontally and bled water out of 100 spaced nozzles all along its length. At the outer end, the arm had a vertical leg supporting its weight. At the bottom of the leg was a wheel with a rubber tire. The wheel was as big as an airplane's landing gear. It rolled around a worn track, endlessly. Reacher watched and waited until the wheel in the nearest field came close. He walked over and stepped alongside it, kept pace with it. The tire came almost to his waist. The boom itself was way over his head. He kept the wheel on his right and tracked it through its long, clockwise circle. He was walking through fine mist. It was cold. The boom hissed loudly. The wheel climbed gentle rises and rolled into low depressions. It was a long, long circle. The boom was maybe 150 feet long, which made the perimeter track more than 300 yards. Pi times diameter. Area was pi times the radius squared, which would therefore be more than 7,800 square yards, more than 1.5 acres, which meant that the wasted corners added up to a little less than 2,200 square yards, more than 21%, more than 500 square yards in each corner, like the shapes in the corners of a target. The Mustang was parked on one of the corners, proportionally the same size as a bullet hole, like one of Charlie's bullet holes in the corners of the paper. Reacher arrived back where he had started, a little wet, his boat shoes muddy. He stepped away from the circle and stood still on the gravel, facing west. On the far horizon, a cloud of crows rose suddenly and then settled. Reacher got back in the car and turned the ignition on, found the clamps on the header rail and the switch on the dash, and lowered the roof. He checked his watch. He had 2 hours until his rendezvous at Franklin's office, so he lay back in the seat and let the sun dry his clothes. He took the folded target out of his pocket and looked at it for a long time. He sniffed it, held it up to the sun, and let the light shine through the crisp, round holes. Then he put it away again in his pocket. He stared upward and saw nothing but sky. He closed his eyes against the glare and started to think about ego and motive and illusion and reality and guilt and innocence and the true nature of randomness.
Chapter 13. Emerson read through Bel Antonio's reports, saw that Reacher had called Helen Roden. He wasn't surprised. It was probably just one of many calls. Lawyers and busybodies working hard to rewrite history. No big shock there. Then he read Bel Antonio's twin questions. Is Reacher left-handed? Did he have access to a vehicle? Answers? Probably. And probably. Southpaws weren't rare. Line up 20 people, and 4 or 5 of them would be left-handed. And Reacher had access to a vehicle now. That was for damn sure. He wasn't in town, and he hadn't left on a bus. Therefore, he had a vehicle, and probably had had one all along. Then Emerson read the final sheet. James Barr had been in Alexandra Dupre's apartment. What the hell was that about? According to Ann Yanni's road maps, Franklin's office was dead center in a tangle of streets right in the heart of the city. Not an ideal destination, not by any means. Construction, the start of rush hour, slowed traffic on surface streets. Reacher was going to be putting a lot of trust in the tint in the Ford Motor Company's glass, that was for sure. He started the motor and put the roof back up. Then he eased off the turnout and headed south. He repassed the Oliver place after 12 minutes, turned west on the county road, and then south again on the 4-lane into town. Emerson went back to Bel Antonio's cell phone report. Reacher had called Helen Roden. They had business. They had matters to discuss. He would go back to her sooner or later, or she would go to him. He picked up the phone, spoke to his dispatcher. "Put an unmarked car in Helen Roden's office," he said. "If she leaves the building, have her follow." Reacher drove past the motor court. He stayed low in the seat and glanced sideways. No sign of any activity, no obvious surveillance. He passed the barber shop and the gun store. Traffic slowed him as he approached the raised highway. Then it slowed him more, to walking speed. His face was feet away from the pedestrians on his right, feet away from the sole drivers on his left. 4 lanes of traffic, the 2 inbound lanes moving slow, the 2 outbound lanes static. He wanted to get away from the sidewalk. He put his turn signal on and forced his way into the next lane. The driver behind his shoulder wasn't happy. "Don't sweat it," Reacher thought. "I learned to drive in a deuce and a half. Time was when I would have rolled right over you." The left-hand lane was moving a little faster. Reacher crept past cars on his right, glanced ahead. There was a police cruiser 3 cars in front, in the right-hand lane. There was a green light in the distance. Traffic in the left-hand lane was approaching it slowly. Traffic in the right-hand lane was approaching it slower still. Each successive car reached the painted line and paused a moment and then jumped the gap. Nobody wanted to block the box. Now Reacher was 2 cars behind the cop. He hung back. The irritated guy behind him honked. Reacher inched forward. Now he was 1 car behind the cop. The light went yellow. The car in front of Reacher sprinted. The light went red. The cop stopped
stepped on the line, and Reacher stopped directly alongside him. He put his elbow on the console and cupped his head in his hand, spread his fingers wide and covered as much of his face as he could, stared straight ahead, up under the header rail, looking at the light, willing it to change. Helen Roden rode down two floors in the elevator and met Ann Yanni in the NBC reception area. NBC was paying for Franklin's time, so it was only fair that Yanni should be at the conference. They rode down to the garage together and got into Helen's Saturn, came up the ramp and out into the sunshine. Helen glanced right and made a left. Didn't register the gray Impala that moved off the curb 20 yards behind her.
The light stayed red an awful long time. Then it went green, and the guy behind Reacher honked, and the cop turned to look. Reacher took off through his field of vision and didn't look back. He filtered into a left turn lane, and the cop car swept past on his right. Reacher watched it jam up again ahead. He didn't want to go through the side-by-side thing again, so he stuck with the left turn. Found himself back in the street with Martha's grocery on it. It was clogged with slow traffic. He shifted on the seat and checked his pants pocket, sifted through the coins by feel, found a quarter, debated with himself. 20 yards? 30? 40? Yes. He pulled into Martha's tiny lot, left the engine running, and slid out of the seat and danced around the hood to the payphone on the wall. He put his quarter in the slot and took out Emerson's torn card, chose the station house number, and dialed.
"Help you?" the desk guy said.
"Police?" Reacher asked.
"Go ahead, sir."
Reacher kept his voice fast and light, rushed and low.
"That guy on the wanted poster? The thing you guys were passing around?"
"Yes, sir."
"He's right here, right now."
"Where?"
"In my drive-thru, the one on the four-lane north of town next to the tire store. He's inside right now, at the counter, eating."
"You sure it's the guy?"
"Looks just like the picture."
"Does he have a car?"
"Big red Dodge pickup."
"Sir, what's your name?"
"Tony Lazzari," Reacher said.
"Anthony Michael Lazzari. Batted .273 in 118 appearances at second base in 1935. Second place finish." Reacher figured he would need to move around the diamond soon. The Yankees hadn't had enough second basemen, or enough non-championship years.
"We're on our way, sir," the desk cop said.
Reacher hung up and slid back into the Mustang, sat still until he heard the first sirens battling north. Helen Roden was halfway down 2nd Street when she caught a commotion in her mirror. A gray Impala sedan lurched out of the lane three cars behind her and pulled a crazy U-turn through the traffic and took off back the way it had come.
"Asshole," she said.
Ann Yanni twisted in her seat.
"Cop car," she said. "You can tell by the antennas."
Reacher made it to Franklin's place about 10 minutes late. It was a two-story brick building. The lower floor looked like some kind of a light industrial unit, abandoned. It had steel shutters over its doors and windows. But the upstairs windows had Venetian blinds with lights behind them. There was an outside staircase leading to an upper door. The door had a white plastic plate on it. Franklin Investigations. There was a parking apron at street level, just a patch of blacktop, one car deep and about 6 wide. Helen Roden's green Saturn was there, and a blue Honda Civic, and a black Chevy Suburban so long that it was overhanging the sidewalk by a foot. The Suburban was Franklin's, Reacher guessed. The Honda was Rosemary Barr's, maybe. He drove past the place without slowing and circled the block. Saw nothing he didn't want to see. So he slotted the Mustang next to the Saturn and got out and locked it. Ran up the staircase and went in the door without knocking.
He found himself in a short hallway with a kitchenette to his right and what he guessed was a bathroom to his left. Up ahead, he could hear voices in a large room. He went in and found Franklin at a desk. Helen Roden and Rosemary Barr in two chairs, huddled in conversation, and Anne Yanni looking out the window at her car. All four turned as he came in.
"Do you know any medical terminology?"
Helen asked him. "Like what?"
"P.A.," she said. "A doctor wrote it. Some kind of an abbreviation."
Reacher glanced at her, then at Rosemary Barr. "Let me guess," he said. "The hospital diagnosed James Barr. Probably a mild case."
"Early onset,"
Rosemary said.
"Whatever it is."
"How did you know?" Helen asked. "Intuition," Reacher said.
"What is it?"
"Later," Reacher said. "Let's do this in order." He turned to Franklin. "Tell me what you know about the victims."
5 random people," Franklin said. "No connection between any of them. No real connection with anything at all. Certainly no connection to James Barr."
"I think you were absolutely right. He didn't shoot them for any reason of his own."
"No, I was absolutely wrong," Reacher said. "Thing is, James Barr didn't shoot them at all."
Grigor Linsky stepped back into his shadowed doorway and dialed his phone.
"I followed the hunch," he said.
"Which was?" the Zek asked.
"With the cops at the lawyer's office, I figured the soldier wouldn't be able to go see her. But obviously, they still have business. So I thought maybe she would go to him. And she did. I followed her. They're together in the private detective's office right now, with the sister and that woman from the television news."
"Are the others with you?"
"We've got the whole block covered, east, west, north, and south."
"Sit tight," the Zek said. "I'll get back to you."
Helen Roden said,
"You want to explain that statement?"
"The evidence is rock solid," Franklin said. Anne Yanni smiled. "A story."
Rosemary Barr just stared.
"You bought your brother a radio," Reacher said to her. "A Bose, for the ball games. He told me that. Did you ever buy him anything else?"
"Like what?"
"Like clothes."
"Sometimes," she said.
"Pants?"
"Sometimes," she said.
"What size?"
"Size,"
she repeated blankly. "What size pants does your brother wear?"
34 waist, 34 leg."
"Exactly," Reacher said. "He's relatively tall."
"How does this help us?"
Helen asked.
"You know anything about numbers games?" Reacher asked her.
"Old-fashioned, illegal numbers. State lotteries, the Powerball, things like that."
"What about them?"
"What's the hardest part of them?"
"Winning,"
Anne Yanni said. Reacher smiled.
"From the player's point of view, sure. But the hardest part for the organizers is picking truly random numbers. True randomness is very hard for humans to achieve. In the old days, numbers runners used the business pages in the newspapers. They would agree in advance, maybe the second page of the stock prices, maybe the second column, the last two figures in the first 6 prices quoted, or the last 6, or the middle 6, or whatever. That came close to true randomness. Now the big lotteries use complicated machines, but you can find mathematicians who can prove the results aren't truly random because humans built the machines."
"How does this help us?"
Helen said.
"Just a train of thought," Reacher said. "I sat all afternoon in Ms. Yanni's car, enjoying the sun, thinking about how hard it is to achieve true randomness."
"Your train is on the wrong track," Franklin said.
James Barr shot 5 people. The evidence is crushing.
You were a cop, Reacher said. You put yourself in danger.